This from the book of Genesis. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." And so he did. And so here we are. Which leads us to ask, how should we treat the animals we are to eat?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 952nd edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Lisbon who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, wherever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Aaron Shore at the controls. Folks, as the good book says, we the people were given domain over all the animals on earth. And if you don't believe what the good book says, well, it's pretty easy to see that we the people went ahead and took control of all the critters anyway. Having been given or having taken all this control, we pause to ask, how should we treat the animals we are to eat? Who better to ask than the person that teaches animal agriculture how to treat animals? And that, of course, would be Dr. Temple Grandin. She is the professor of animal sciences at the Colorado State University in Fort Collins. Dr. Temple, thank you for joining us on the Food Chain.
It's absolutely great to be here today on the Food Chain.
So you're kind of like frozen in Havre, Montana this morning.
They had, it wasn't Havre that caused the problem. It was the Denver airport that was nasty yesterday, and they tend to cancel all the small regional jets unless they keep the big planes going.
Right. So there's a big, huge foul up across the land, but we have the ability to use telephones and make that connection. So from Fort Collins, you're going to Denver and then to Fort Collins and then on to Pacific Grove, California, where you're going to be speaking pretty soon. And the subject of your speech will be decoding animal behavior and translating understanding to animal welfare. And I guess, you know, I've been looking forward to having this conversation with you for a long time, mostly because of your involvement with autism. And I did a program some time ago with respect to Amish and autism, and your name came up, and I thought, wow, what a fascinating person. And I'm so happy to have you here today. And when it gets right down to it, I think that all of us who eat food, eat meat especially, owe you a big thank you, Dr. Temple Grandin, for the work that you have done, because I think when it gets right down to it, I think everybody who eats food wants to eat food that was grown ethically. And even those who grow the food or produce the food want to be producing food that has been produced ethically. And if there's anybody who's brought ethics to animal agriculture, it would be you. You now have designed equipment that handles almost half the cattle. Beef cattle in Canada and United States. So you single-handedly have really had a huge impact on this big, brawny, beefy industry. So I just have to ask you, how on earth did you do that?
Well, it started out one little project at a time. Back in the early 70s, I became a livestock editor for Farmer Ranch and the State Magazine. Started out writing one little article at a time. Then I wrote some articles for our national magazines. It sort of, you know, you start out small, a lot of freelance work. You know, you design something that works for somebody, and then you design something for somebody else. Now, the thing I want to emphasize is equipment's only half the equation. When I first started out, I thought I could fix everything with just equipment. Equipment design can fix half of things. The other half is management. You've got to have management that cares about doing things right. You know, I just can't emphasize that enough. Management's got to buy into you know, low stress cattle handling, and that we're going to put electric prods away, and we're going to stop screaming at cattle and things like that. And management's going to decide that they're going to make some changes in that department.
So not only did you change the equipment that we use to process our animals, but you changed the people. Now, you must have had some kind of profound leverage to change people's behavior.
I'll explain to you what that leverage was. I have a saying, heat softens steel, and then I can bend it into pretty grill. So I had good systems out in the plants that were put in the in the 80s and the early 90s, a lot of good equipment out there. And there were a few plants that were really good that did things right, but there were a whole bunch of others that did not. And in 1999, I was hired by McDonald's Corporation to teach their food safety auditors how to do an animal welfare audit that I developed. They had very simple scoring. Like, okay, if you don't shoot 95% of the cattle on the first shot and get them dead, you're going to fail the audit. If more than three cattle feller and moo in the stun box, you're going to fail the audit. If more than 1% fall down, you're going to fail the audit. They had to make these numbers. And very early on, two plants were kicked off the approved supplier list. And that sent a message out there. And one of the reasons why that scoring system worked is it was simple. It was like traffic rules. Stop sign means stop. Speed limit signs, yeah, usually allowed about 5 miles over. You know, it's clear what is required. And it wasn't a whole book full of stuff. And it really worked. What we've got to do is when a big company like that decides they're going to move, we've got to come up with sensible things that are going to work. And I took McDonald's executives and executives from other companies out on their first trips to slaughterhouses and farms, and I saw some undercover boss moments. You ever seen that show, Undercover Boss?
Right, right.
You know, like big boss gets out there and sees something really bad. Well, I saw some of those exact same kind of reactions. And they go, ooh, that really is a problem. We do need to fix things. But on the other hand, truth is always somewhere in the middle. And when things are going right, they go, well, that's not quite as bad as what all the activists say it is. You know, reality is usually somewhere in the middle.
So the industry itself was under tremendous pressure because we've all seen the photographs or the video of you know, some pretty bad treatment of animals in the confined animal feeding operations.
I've seen those videos, and you know, there's some very bad dairy videos out there, bad pig videos that are out right now, and it's a lack of, that stuff is a lack of management. I mean, pitchforks in the milking parlor, that's a lack of management. The other thing is you cannot understaff and overwork. You understaff and overwork, people just get so tired that there's just no way they can do a good job. You just absolutely cannot see that.
Not only that, but you have to have people who have the know-how. I mean, it does take some skill to do this job, right?
Absolutely, and you've got to have people to teach the people. And what I have found on training people on good animal handling, that about 20% of people, when you train them on low-stress methods, they'll stay good. They just are naturally good stockmen, and with a little bit of instruction, they'll stay good stock people. Then there's a big bunch of people in the middle that will stay good if you constantly monitor them. And then there's about 10% at the bottom of the heap that actually enjoy hurting animals, and they just should not be there. Because we found with the meatpacking plant that about 10% of the employees just had to be removed from live animal handling. That every time their back was turned, they had electric prods out, and they were doing stuff they shouldn't be doing.
So what really gave you the leverage to change people behavior in animal welfare was the fact that these large companies like McDonald's and Wendy's...
That's right.
And they were, of course, kind of forced to do it by the consumers of their products. So the people who saw those videos said, hey, wait a minute, what are you doing here? And the company said, well, we better do something. And so you took them to the actual abattoir and said, look what's happening. And they say, oh, we better fix this.
Well, right now, there's getting to be similar things going on in the clothing industry. These factories that have fallen down, factories that have burned up people, killed 1,000 people, killed 100 people in another factory. There's companies that are going to have to clean up these clothing factories. It's the same sort of thing.
And you are, as I said earlier, very well known around the world as an advocate for those who have autism. And this is a question I guess I always wanted to ask Dr. Temple Grandin. Do you see a correlation between our food and our autism?
No. Autism is mainly genetic, and it's a complicated genetic where there's lots of little code variations. Because you take personality traits, are kind of like a music mixing board. You can adjust the volume to be more fearful or less fearful. You know, like if you look at dogs, for example, you've got the skinny lab that wants to chase the ball all the time, then you've got the heavy set lab that makes a great service dog for a person in a wheelchair. That's differences in that kind of, you know, personality of those dogs. I think a brain can be made to be more social, or a brain can be made to be more thinking or cognitive. And when the geeks and nerds become mild autism, you know, half of the people in Silicon Valley probably have some mild autism. The people that make radio station engineering work, you know, if you didn't have some geeks and nerds and some mild autism, you wouldn't have anybody to run your radio station electronics.
Can you hold that, Dr. Temple? We have to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll finish the thought on autism. Michael Olson, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Dr. Temple Grandin, Animals and Animal Welfare, right back. Welcome back, folks. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain Radio Program, where we're talking with Dr. Temple Grandin, and we're picking up a thread on autism. She is very well known around the world for two things. One is animal welfare and the impact she has had on our animal agriculture industry, but also on autism as well. So we're kind of talking a little bit about autism. And my question, of course, was, is there a correlation between food and autism? And Dr. Temple said, she said no, right?
Well, no, autism is mainly genetic. Now, there's some people with autism that have digestive issues, almost like celiac disease sort of type of stuff. And that's not everybody with autism, but there's some people that have some of those kinds of problems. And they're sometimes helped by going on a casein and gluten-free diet. But the vast majority of people with autism, no, the diets don't work on the vast majority. It's a subgroup where they work.
Well, thank you very much for that. I've always wondered because I did a program with respect to autism in the Amish community, and it was claimed that there are so few people with autism in the Amish community that there must be something environmental.
I think the problem is autism is a very big fact, and it goes all the way from Einstein, who had speech delay until age 3, to Steve Jobs, to somebody that remains nonverbal and extremely handicapped. Now, about half of the autism spectrum is fully verbal, but they're just not that social. Well, the Amish have a lot of emphasis in their society on, you know, teaching people job skills really young. They do a lot of different, woodworking, all different kinds of products that they sell. And some of those kids that are mildly autistic, they're just kind of geeky and nerdy. They just put them to work in the wood shop, and they do just fine.
Mm-hmm. So you don't really know.
Calling autism is mainly going to be the ones that are nonverbal or just very, very poorly verbal.
Good.
Remember, autism is a behavioral profile. It is not a definite diagnosis like you have tuberculosis. Okay, when I went to Australia, I could check off on the customs form. I never had tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is an absolutely definite diagnosis. Autism is a kid has a certain behavioral profile, and they label him with autism. Also, I'm sure the Amish are much more strict about just teaching manners. But the autistic kid, some of the social circuits in the brain aren't hooked up. So they've got to be taught to say please and thank you. They've got to be taught, you know, the social rules, just like they're in a foreign country. And the Amish are probably pretty strict about that. So the milder cases aren't even going to get identified. Where in our looser society, those tend to show up a lot more. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing also way too many kids getting addicted to video games. And the Amish, I'm sure, do not have video games.
Well, let me ask you this then. You've been diagnosed with autism, I guess, since very, very early age. And somehow you have managed to take that condition and transcend it and become a person who's very adept at managing animals. Does that condition help you work with animals in any way?
Well, I'm an extreme visual thinker. Everything I think about is in a picture. And animals are sensory-based things. They don't think in words. Imagine if all your memories were pictures or little audio clips of sound, all this detailed sensory information. Now, I used to think that everybody thought in pictures. when I was young, I didn't know that my thinking was different. Now, not everybody with autism thinks in pictures. There's other people with autism that think more in mathematics. That's going to be the people that are good at programming out in Silicon Valley. It's been interesting for me to realize that not everybody does think the same way. And I discussed this in my new book, The Autistic Brain. And there's actually scientific evidence now for two kinds of visualizers. You have the object visualizer like me that thinks in photorealistic pictures. And then you have the pattern thinker who thinks more in mathematical patterns. And they're going to be very good at things like computer programming.
Wow, so there it is. So then let's move on to the abattoir, which, of course, is where we process our animals to eat. And you're able to somehow look at the situation and find lots of things wrong by watching the behavior of the animals. And maybe we can go through some of those things that have an adverse impact on animal behavior, and then you can tell us how, you know, making changes in those things really helps the animal with respect to its welfare. I guess maybe start off with some of the real simple elements like lighting.
Yes, definitely. When I first started out in my career, I wanted to find out if cattle knew they were going to get slaughtered. So I would go over to the Swift plant that they had in Arizona. This was back in the 70s, and I'd go out to a feed yard or a ranch, and I found the cattle behaved the same way in both places. And they were afraid of things like going into the dark building. So you lit it up with lights, they'd go in. They were afraid of things like a chain hanging down, a reflection on shiny metal that jiggled, seeing people up ahead. And if you got rid of these distractions, then the animals would walk right up the chute. And I've gone into a number of plants where just with some portable lights put in strategic places, and cardboard put up so they wouldn't see people up ahead, the cattle would then walk right up the chute. You know, they're very controlled by their vision, and when they're calm, they'll look right at the distractions they don't like. Like maybe they're seeing a hard hat up ahead kind of bouncing up and down, and I put a shield up so they don't see that. And then I call it my lights and cardboard, and I'm amazed. I'm still kind of amazed how well I can make it work. I can put a piece of cardboard up so they don't see a lady checking IDs. I put a tarp up to block the sunbeam that's coming into the roof, put a light on a restrainer entrance, and then I also get them to handle the cattle better. Moving small groups, really important with cattle and pigs. Good handling is going to require more walking. And you can make some of the older facilities, you know, even work decently doing that.
And, of course, those of us who've seen all of the nasty videos of animal abattoirs and CAFOs, what we see are the rough handling of animals and people forcing animals to do things that the animals don't want to do. And what you recognize is the fact that, well, there's just a lot of little things out there in those environments that frighten the animal, and that it can be changed, and then the animals will therefore be a lot more compliant.
Well, the other thing on nasty video, you know, to say that every abattoir, every farm is using pitchforks in the milking parlor, eating up dairy cows, and another really nasty thing, that's sort of like saying everybody's a drunk driver. You know, what if I went out and I took a bunch of car accident pictures, and I said, well, this is driving. Well, that wouldn't be very realistic. And then there are some things we're going to need to change. The pig industry's got to find a better way to euthanize piglets, and slamming them on the floor is not acceptable. That needs to get changed. But then other things like pitchforks in the milking parlor, that's just bad management. And yes, that was terrible. Absolutely terrible. But to say that everybody does that would be far like saying everybody drives drunk. It's not the case.
Mm-hmm. And when you point these out, it takes some empathy, I guess, some real genuine empathy to see those things in an environment that would confuse the animals. It takes some genuine perception. How do you go about seeing those things that other people simply don't see, or perhaps don't want to see, or don't want to take the time to see?
Well, the first thing that very first work I ever did is I noticed that little distractions like reflections on metal and things like that were things that made the animal stop. Now, lots of times you stand there and wait long enough, your leader will look at the chain hanging down and eventually walk through and the other cattle will follow. but I don't have time to wait, you know, 5 minutes at a packing plant, not when it's $250 a minute to run the plant. I've got to take the distraction out of there, and then the animal is going to, you know, he's going to walk right up the chute. Also, I've studied some of the science of animal emotional systems. Yes, animals definitely have emotions. They have fear. And then you have separation distress, which is another emotion. Cattle do not like being alone. You leave an animal alone in the chute, it's going to get really upset because it's away from its buddy.
Mm-hmm.
No, they don't like being alone.
They're herd critters, right?
Well, they're social, and cattle are, and both cattle and sheep, and pigs even, they get by themselves. Away from their mates, they can get really upset, and that's separation stuff.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break. Dr. Temple Grandin, the professor of animal sciences at Colorado State University up there in Fort Collins. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, we're talking about animal welfare and how a few simple things can make it a lot easier for everybody concerned when it comes to our animal welfare. Do stay tuned, right back. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Dr. Temple Grandin, who is up there in Havre, Montana, waiting for a flight out. And Dr. Temple, you travel all over the place. You're one very busy lady.
Well, I've got lots of different places I travel to.
Yes, you do. And following you around is kind of a fun one. You know, we're talking a little bit about what it takes to make it a lot easier for animals at the abattoir, which is where we process animals into the meats that we eat. And it was essentially you people out there who were seeing these videos of animal cruelty in the abattoirs and in the various confined animal feeding operations in the dairies and whatnot. You see videos of people pushing animals around and hitting them in the butt and trying to make them move. And your complaints were heard by those big companies that sell lots of meat, like McDonald's and Wendy's. And so those companies went to Dr. Temple Grandin and say, what can we do to make it better? And so Dr. Temple Grandin looked at the way we handle our animals and saw things that really were very simple that could be corrected that would make it a lot easier for the animals and for the animal handlers. And some of those things were very simple as changing the flooring, right, Dr. Temple?
Well, we basically, when we started those McDonald's audits, we had to get a lot of non-slip flooring installed in sunboxes and in the unloading area. That's a major area. We did a lot of things with lighting. We also had to repair a lot of broken equipment. There were plants back in 1999 where the stun guns were broken, and yeah, they shot, but they didn't shoot with enough power to really work. You know, the plants had to maintain their equipment, and they're so much better now than they used to be. The USDA in the last 6 or 7 years has gotten a lot more strict on Humane Slaughter Act enforcement. Now, I have some videos up on the Internet that show things being done right. I've got beef plant video tour with Temple Grandin, pork plant video tour with Temple Grandin that just shows how a plant works. You know, big plant work when things are being done right. And we didn't pick over the footage to find absolutely the best footage. Those videos were shot in a single morning in the plant. And we just went in there, and what they were doing right then was, you know, like stunning, for example, he shot maybe about 3 minutes of footage, and it's just there. That's how it runs. And I just explained how it works. And, you know, now sometimes, you know, they'll, you know, might shoot hours of footage and then pick out the absolute, you know, the five cattle or something went wrong. And yeah, and there are those that dairies and those pig farms where they had some of those problems, they had severe management.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Temple, when we take animals to the abattoir to have them processed, do the animals know what's in store for them?
Well, I find if you got rid of the distractions, they walk right up the chute. Now, if you leave a single animal alone in a chute, let's say in a small plant where he's got to wait a long time, he's going to get upset because he's going to have separation distress. But I've seen chutes where they only had a 5 foot, 6 inch wall where the cattle could easily just hop out, and they don't. Usually they're going to get slaughtered. They ought to be much wilder at the plant than they are at the farm being handled. And they seem to behave the same way in both places. And when I first started my career, in a single day, I'd go back and forth between the slip plant and the feed yards in Arizona. And the handling of the plant was actually calmer than at the feedlots. Some of the feedlots back in the 70s did not have good handling.
So it's really in the handling that makes it all work. Now, how did you change the behavior of people? I mean, it's one thing, you know, to recognize that a hanging chain or a reflection or something like that it can cause the animals to pause and to rebel. But what about the people? How did you change?
I found in some place that had good managers, but when I first started out, that maybe 20% of the places, I could go in and work on their handling and really change the people. But the thing that made light years worth a change was the year of 1999 and 2000 when we implemented those McDonald's audits. And now we had the economic power of McDonald's and Wendy's behind that. And if they didn't do it, they were going to get kicked off the approved supplier list. And out of 75 pork and beef plants, three plant managers were either fired or retired. There was a lot of equipment maintenance that had to get done. People had to fix their stuff. You know, I hate to say that this was a situation where it was the stick. And you have to use the stick very wisely. And one of the things that made it work is the scoring was objective. The plant could either make their numbers, like 95% on the first shot, dead, everything dead that's hanging on the rail, no more than 3% mooing and fellering in the stun box. They had to really put the electric prods away, 1% falling score. They could make those numbers, and they passed the audit. And what's going to, the same thing's going to be happening right now with the clothing industry. Now, if these factories have burned down, these factories have collapsed and killed all these people, these big customers have got to go in there and they're going to have to clean it up.
Wow. So the economic power of those big companies really, you know, gave Temple Grandin the leverage she needed to enforce major changes, not only in the structure and the equipment, but also in the behavior of the people. Now, it's said that your inventions or the equipment that you have designed is now handling 50% of the cattle in the United States and Canada. What kind of equipment changes did you make?
Well, one of the biggest changes was a piece of equipment called the center track conveyor system. The older type restrainer works with 2B conveyors, and the cattle they didn't enter that very well. I came with a new type of system, worked on developing a new type of system where the cattle straddle a conveyor. And the initial invention of that system actually was done at the University of Connecticut years ago and was actually financed partly by the Humane Society of the United States. And they had made a wooden model in a shop, and they showed that this was a low-stress way to hold an animal. And then my job in the 80s was to put this into an actual real commercial plant. Wow. And take this from the research lab into the plants. We didn't have to force them to do that.
Dr. Temple, we can put the equipment in, but it's not just the equipment, is it?
Oh, absolutely not. And the thing that I found all through the 80s, the early 90s, it was easy selling people the equipment. They thought they put the right equipment in, magically solves all their problems. The thing that often was difficult was getting people to operate that equipment correctly. And then when the McDonald's audit came along in 1999, that made people operate it right. I also want to add something you brought up about the word dominion in the Bible. I went to Israel about 10 years ago to do an autism talk, and I decided to ask people in Israel what the word dominion means in Hebrew, because you've got to remember that, you know, King James Version of the Bible is a translation in English. And I just asked them, 5 or 6 different people, independently, what does the word dominion mean? And they said it meant stewardship.
And what does that mean to you with respect to animals, then?
Well, that means stewardship has a little bit different meaning than dominion. Dominion just implies you can do anything you want. Stewardship implies that you've got to be responsible for what you do. You know, it has a little different meaning than dominion.
Mm-hmm. So the good Lord was not just saying that you have control over everything. He was saying you have responsibility over everything.
Well, that's what stewardship means. And all I can say is that's what I found out when I went to Israel, and I talked to native Hebrew speakers, and I asked them, and that's what they told me.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break. Dr. Temple Grandin, professor of animal sciences at Colorado State University up there in Fort Collins. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, we're talking about animal welfare and how a few simple things can make it a lot easier for everybody concerned when it comes to our animal welfare. Do stay tuned, right back. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson talking with Dr. Temple Grandin. Can you think of any state that you haven't been in, Dr. Temple?
I've been in every state in the U.S., been in every province in Canada, and I've been in about 30 other countries.
And for the people who don't know you very well, you really have become a focal point in the animal husbandry industry, especially beef cattle, I suppose, and hogs, in that you're bringing the whole notion of being able to read animals' behavior, and in that reading, I come to understand them and making the process of raising animals a lot better for all concerned, for the animals and the people.
Well, the biggest thing I've been working on is working on improving the slaughtering process. I mean, one of the things that people always ask me is, do cattle or pigs know they're going to get slaughtered? And I had to answer that question very early in my career. And I found they behave exactly the same way as the slaughterhouse as they behave going up the chute at the farm. If they knew they were going to get slaughtered, they should be going wild and trying to jump out. And I have found that animals are afraid of a lot of little distractions we tend to not notice, you know, like reflections on the floor, shiny metal that jiggles, seeing a person walk by, seeing a vehicle, seeing moving equipment, maybe a sunbeam. And if you get rid of these distractions, they'll walk right up the chute in the plant. I'm kind of amazed. I can go in and put a light on a stun box entrance because they're kind of scared of the dark, and they'll walk right in, put up a piece of cardboard so they don't see a lady that's checking cattle IDs, and then they'll walk right on by her. It's they tend to notice visual detail.
Well, Dr. Temple, we city people really lost track of a lot of things with respect to where our food comes from and how it comes to us. And of course, one of the things that we really lost track of is that the things that we eat have to be slaughtered. And I guess that's the word the industry used. When I was raised on the farm, what we did with our animals was that we slaughtered them and then we butchered them. Is that are those the terms we still use?
Well, they're trying to use the term now, harvest.
A harvest.
And call it a harvest plant rather than a slaughter plant. And I have some problems with that. I could see softening it down to processing plant, but not harvest. That's something you do with grain. And the thing is, we've got to make sure that these animals that we raise for food, we give them a life worth living. That is really super important. And then when it's time to go to the harvest plant or the slaughterhouse, it's put down without any pain, very little fear. That's what we owe the animals that we use for food. And you got to do things right.
Dr. Temple, would you describe exactly how we go about harvesting or slaughtering the animal, processing them?
Well, basically, you unload the animal into a yard, like a big stockyard, similar to kind of what you might have at an auction. And the animals go up a chute, usually made out of concrete in a plant. And they've been up many chutes before for veterinary work, and they behave about the same way. And then in the smaller plants, they'll put the cattle in a small stall called a stun box. In the big plants, they go through a conveyor restrainer system. And you can see that on my video, Beef Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin. Also got Pork Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin. Now, in a smaller plant where they put them in a stun box, they just walk into this little stall, and a man reaches over the top of the stall with a captive bolt stunner, which will have the same effect as a high-caliber firearm, and shoots the animal right in the middle of the forehead, and then the bolt retracts for the next animal. And it kills the animal instantly when it's done correctly. In fact, I developed an auditing program for evaluating plants. And in order to pass a McDonald's audit, if you don't shoot 95% perfectly on the first shot, you're going to fail the McDonald's audit.
Wow.
We also score vocalization. If you've got cattle mooing and bellowing in the stun box, and you got more than three of them doing that out of 100, you're going to fail the audit. You know, you score the things that really matter. And when you keep numbers on things, that helps to keep things good. It's just like traffic rules. If you didn't have speed limits, can you imagine what the highway would be like?
What do you see people doing wrong on the killing process?
Well, equipment maintenance is a big issue. This captive bolt gun has to be kept well maintained. Also, just supervision of people. Management's got to make sure people do things right. And there's a lot of issues about chain speed of plants. And You can have a plant with a real high line speed if it's set up and staffed correctly for that speed. Now, one of the things that can be a big mess is if you understaff or you overwork a piece of equipment. If you push a piece of equipment past its capacity, you can have a real mess. I've seen that happen with small plant, maybe getting pushed from 26 cattle an hour up to 35. That was a big mess of slamming doors. But on the other hand, you can have a plant running 390 cattle an hour, and they're just moving through at a slow walk. Management's got to care about doing things right. Now, the USDA's gotten a lot more strict about enforcing the Humane Slaughter Act, and then you've got many large customers auditing the plants. In fact, two of the big companies, Cargill and JBS, actually have video auditing over the stunning area, so people can look in over the Internet and make sure that they're doing things right.
Wow, so they're really being proactive. Now, what do you think is the most effective in making things better, the government supervision or the industry, the meat processing industry enforcing those rules
I have found that the most effective enforcers have been large customers that are buying the product, companies like McDonald's and Wendy's. Now, the clothing industry's had a lot of problems. Factories falling down and killing people, factories burning up and killing people. Well, what's going to make that change is when the big customers that buy those clothes, you know, the Walmarts and the other companies, decide they're going to make them fix that. That's been some of the best enforcers. Large customers with large economic power.
So that really comes down to we consumers making demands on the industry, right?
That's right. And when a large company like McDonald's insists on things being done right, it gets done right. In fact, I worked on implementing the McDonald's animal welfare audits in 1999, and I saw more change than I'd seen in a 25-year career prior to that.
Wow.
I find that people are real willing to buy the equipment. Oh, it was easy selling the equipment prior to the McDonald's audits, but getting them to actually run it right, that was the difficult thing.
Well, we're with Michael Olson with Temple Grandin. We will be right back after these messages. Do stay tuned.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land. We can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Folks, we have a few minutes left and so much to talk about with Dr. Temple Grandin, the professor of animal sciences at the Colorado State University, Fort Collins. Dr. Temple, we can put the equipment in, but it's not just the equipment, is it?
Oh, absolutely not. And the thing that I found all through the 80s and the early 90s, it was easy selling people the equipment. They thought they put the right equipment in, magically solves all their problems. The thing that often was difficult was getting people to operate that equipment correctly. And then when the McDonald's audits came along in 1999, that made people operate it right. I also want to add something you brought up about the word dominion in the Bible. I went to Israel about 10 years ago to do an autism talk, and I decided to ask people in Israel what the word dominion means in Hebrew, because you've got to remember that, you know, King James Version of the Bible is a translation in English. And I just asked them, 5 or 6 different people, independently, what does the word dominion mean? And they said it meant stewardship.
And what does that mean to you with respect to animals, then?
Well, that means stewardship has a little bit different meaning than dominion. Dominion just implies you can do anything you want. Stewardship implies that you've got to be responsible for what you do. You know, it has a little different meaning than dominion.
Mm-hmm. So the good Lord was not just saying that you have control over everything. He was saying you have responsibility over everything.
Well, that's what stewardship means. And all I can say is that's what I found out when I went to Israel, and I talked to native Hebrew speakers, and I asked them, and that's what they told me.
And there it is. Dr. Temple, what happens when animal rights activists meet Dr. Temple Grandin?
Well, there's some animal rights activists that really like me, and then there's some that think no matter what you do, eating meat is evil, and then they're not going to like me. You know, if you want to get rid of the meat industry, but I eat meat. Also, I find that I couldn't be on a vegan diet if I wanted to be. I get too lightheaded. I've got to have some animal protein. I'm actually an O blood type. I've found other people that are left. Vegans tend to be an O blood type. But we've got to treat animals right. You know, they have a nervous system. They feel fear. They feel pain. It's not like, you know, weed or something like that that, you know, doesn't have a nervous system. And we've got to treat animals right. We've got to give animals a life worth living. That's the wording used by the Farm Animal Welfare Council in England. And they've got to have a life worth living. Another thing I've thought about, they never would be born if we didn't raise them. But we've got to not push the biology too hard. I'm seeing problems now today with the dairy cow. The biology's getting pushed so hard that she's having problems reproducing. I've seen cattle pushed too hard with feed additives that make them lame and sore and stiff. That is something that's not acceptable, pushing the biology to the point where the animal really starts having, you know, painful problems.
It sure goes against the basic notion, then, of stewardship, does it not?
That's right. And I think stewardship's a really, really good word.
So it's a word we want to take and hold on to. Is it possible, Dr. Temple Grandin, for us to treat animals humanely?
Well, humane can sometimes be a loaded word. I'm out at a ranch now in Montana. He's got beautiful Angus cattle. And I was out yesterday on the road in the tractor and I'm feeding the hay to them. They're nice fat cows. It feeds his cows enough so they stay nice and in good condition. You know, a lot of ranchers really care about their animals.
And there you go. And that's, and the caring is
agriculture off the land. A lot of land you can't crop. And the only thing you can grow on that land is grazing livestock.
And there you go, and that is stewardship we're talking about. Dr. Temple Grandin, the professor of animal sciences at Colorado State University, thank you so much for joining us on The Food Chain, and thank you all for tuning in out there. Remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.